you come to Roman numeral 24 on your outline, the loss of optimism regarding reason. Yesterday we looked at the Enlightenment movements of the 18th century and the 17th century as well. We considered English deism and the French Enlightenment, a number of movements there and important names, the German Enlightenment. And what I'd like to do now in this particular part of the lecture is offer a commentary on the outcome of the Enlightenment. And to understand the history of thought, you really must recognize that for all of its grandeur, the Enlightenment led to failure and to a loss of optimism regarding man's use of reason. But to see that, let's kind of summarize this Enlightenment optimism that we've already seen in general across the various nations and cultures that we've looked at. Particularly Enlightenment optimism regarding the rationality of the universe and the rationality of man. The 1600s and the 1700s are often called the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment. And as I've indicated, most commentators considered it an age of optimism, where there was no reason why there shouldn't be continued and indeed unlimited progress made by man. The first characteristic of Enlightenment optimism is the notion of progress and the perfectibility of man. Progress and the perfectibility of man, well illustrated in Jean Condorcet's Sketch for a Historical Picture of the Progress of the Human Mind, published in 1794. Condorcet, his dates are 1743 to 1794, was a prominent encyclopedist in that French movement, an excellent mathematician, made contributions to probability theory. In 1769, he was made a member of the French Academy. 1787, of the many things he wrote, he wrote The Life of Voltaire. Condorcet supported the French Revolution. Nevertheless, he was later proscribed by the Jacobins when he opposed them, you know, the development of the Jacobean Party. And the ironic thing is, Schaeffer points this out as well, is that this Sketch for a Historical Picture of the Progress of the Human Mind was written while he was in hiding from the Jacobean Party. Later he was captured. He ended up dying in prison, maybe being poisoned to death. But nevertheless, here's a man who writes about progress and the perfectibility of man. Let me just quote a little bit from this work. We don't have a lot of time this morning, but I want you to get a sense of it. He writes, "The general laws directing the phenomena of the universe are necessary and constant. Why should this principle be any less true for the development of the intellectual and moral faculties of man than for the operations of nature? Our hopes for the future condition of the human race can be subsumed under three important heads: the abolition of inequality between nations, the progress of equality within each nation, and the true perfection of mankind." He tells us later, "Nature has set no limit for the realization of our hopes." And then, "The time will therefore come when the sun will shine only on free men who know no other master but their reason." Isn't that a great line? When this great age comes and the human race is being perfected, everyone will have less work to do, will produce more, and satisfy his wants more fully. Sounds like President Clinton, doesn't it? The average length of human life will be increased. It's reasonable to hope that all other diseases may likewise disappear. And then finally, how consoling for the philosopher who laments the errors, the crimes, the injustices which still pollute the earth, and of which he is often the victim. Oh yes, he wrote this while he, the philosopher, is the victim of these crimes on the earth. Is the view of the human race emancipated from its shackles, released from the empire of fate, and from that of the enemies of its progress, advancing with a firm and sure step along the path of truth, virtue, and happiness. Well, sounds a little schmaltzy today, I realize, but that gives you a sense of the Enlightenment optimism about progress and the perfectibility of man. As you can see, what Condorcet represents here is a kind of a this-worldly heaven on earth. And his commitment is obviously a religious faith, isn't it? This is not an empirical generalization. If he looked at the world round about him, I mean to the degree he could see it in hiding, would he have empirically drawn the conclusion that man is good and perfectible and we're making progress? No, he was interpreting the world in light of a previous faith commitment about the nature of man. Let's go on to a second element of Enlightenment optimism, and that is the notion that we live in a closed universe. A closed universe. The writers of the Enlightenment wish to exclude from nature and also from man's reasoning anything that was unpredictable or miraculous, especially the intervention of supernatural forces from outside of the universe understood as a machine. The writers of the Enlightenment were atheists on the one hand, or at best, deists. Thirdly, Enlightenment optimism encompasses an antipathy to Christian orthodoxy. An antipathy to Christian orthodoxy. You remember what I told you yesterday about Rousseau, that religion is basically this sentiment, this underlying feeling that we have, and it has nothing to do with rational creeds or declarations of truth. Let me quote Rousseau for you. "I see God everywhere in his works. I feel him within myself. I behold him all around me. But if I try to ponder him himself, if I try to find out where he is, what he is, what is his substance, he escapes me." Okay, we don't want orthodoxy, we don't want creed. Trying to find out about God, truth about God, will escape you. But Rousseau says, "I feel God inside me, and I see him all around in the natural world." The philosophers of the Enlightenment had contempt for the Christian faith. They had contempt for the creed or creeds of Christendom, and they had even more contempt for the institution of the church. In his book, The Social Contract, Rousseau distinguished between what he called the religion of man and the Christianity of his own day and culture. And then he went on to say that the religion of man over against Christianity is identified with the teaching of the Gospels. That religion is holy, sublime, and true. But Christianity, he said, clouds the true worship of divinity with vain ceremonies. Okay, so the optimism that we're referring to in the Enlightenment makes reference to their notion of progress, man's perfectibility, that man lives in a closed universe, and the antipathy to Christian orthodoxy. This antipathy to Christian orthodoxy led to the idea of a neutral historiography. Christianity is the study, can be studied in a neutral fashion. The history of Christianity, and especially the history claimed in the Gospels, can be studied in a neutral fashion. And when you study the Bible in a neutral fashion, the Enlightenment scholar said, you will be suspicious of the New Testament and the Bible in general, because the authors there were obviously interested parties. They had their biases. And when we consider what they had to say, in every case we must use as a standard of acceptance whether what they say is agreeable to experience. So when you read the Gospels and you read of prophecies and miracles, is that agreeable to experience? Is that the sort of thing that's common, you know, in your own experience of the world? No. Well, and then who wrote these things? Well, biased people, obviously, pushing their vain ceremonies. Therefore, you draw the conclusion what? That the Bible's not a reliable historical book. This, allegedly, the result of neutral historiography. Well, you've had enough training in these 2 weeks, I think, that you can see through this claim of neutrality. Were those men who said that whatever happens in the Bible is to be evaluated on the basis of common human experience, was that a neutral commitment on their part? Or was that a decision in advance that the Bible cannot relate unique things? You see, all in the name of scholarship that is neutral, they were veiling their own vicious prejudices. Fourthly, Enlightenment optimism is seen in the seeking of orderliness everywhere. Orderliness. Because Enlightenment thinkers rejected divine intervention, they felt they could then study the universe as a completely regular system, an orderly system. A good example here is Charles Baron de Montesquieu, whose dates are 1689 to 1755. Montesquieu was a French social essayist who was influenced by John Locke. In 1748, he wrote a book entitled The Spirit of the Laws, in which he argues natural law precedes society, that our laws cannot be grounded in simple social custom or the decrees of the government, because natural law precedes society. Let me give you a quote in terms, just to show you the seeking of orderliness everywhere without divine intervention. He says, "Laws in their most general signification are the necessary relations arising from the nature of things. In this sense, all beings have their laws, the deity his laws, the material world its laws, the intelligences superior to man their laws, the beast their laws, man his laws." Pretty good sentence. I mean, you hear laws enough times in there, you get the point, right? Everything is law-like. God is law-like. The world is law-like. Animals are law-like. Man is law-like. Everything's part of this closed system, if you will. God doesn't intervene, and what we study is the law-likeness of all of reality. So despite the differences between human beings, there is an underlying regularity to human conduct that can be studied, according to Montesquieu. It won't surprise you then that he went on to recommend that the way a government is organized from place to place in the world needs to be adjusted to the psychological makeup of the people who are being governed, and that their psychological makeup, he argued, has a lot to do with the environmental factors such as climate. He argued that climate affected the psychology of people, And so the government that you have in a warm climate will not in all respects be like the government you have in a cold climate. And I realize that's a rather rough and ready approach, but it's the same underlying idea that we have today. People think that you look at the environment to determine man's behavior, and then you have to adjust the man's behavior given the different environments you find him in. So here's an attempt to use an empirical approach to solve social problems, right? We'll be scientific, we'll be reasonable, and we can get our social problems taken care of. And that leads me to the fifth point of Enlightenment optimism, a confidence in reason to solve man's problems. A confidence in reason to solve man's problems. You realize, as we have lectured the last few days, that the notion of reason is understood in greatly divergent ways by the different schools of philosophy. Not every philosopher who says we've got to use reason is talking about the same thing as every other philosopher who appeals to reason. But nevertheless, whatever they meant by reason, the Enlightenment thinkers generally agreed that there is in man an innate power that is equal, or at least nearly equal, in all men. If we develop man's reason through education, man will be able to solve all the problems that arise in the course of his life. Reason shows him that nature is orderly, and reason will show him that his interest will always harmonize with the interest of other men around him. So if we could only educate men to use their reason, they would understand the world in an orderly way and be able to have a harmonious social order. They could solve all their problems. Now, because men are reasonable and simply need education, we don't need a large civil government with a lot of laws. The Enlightenment approach was to respect the decency and the dignity of individual men who are reasonable and educated and can be counted on to regulate their lives accordingly. So there was a confidence in man's reason. Let me give you as an example Immanuel Kant from his short little essay entitled, What is Enlightenment? And I quote, "Enlightenment is man's release from self-imposed tutelage. Tutelage is the inability to use one's natural powers without direction from another." That's significant. Kant is saying, don't take your direction from another person. Develop your own natural powers of reasoning. So he goes on to say, "Dare to reason. Have courage to use your own mind," is the motto of the Enlightenment. He said, men are releasing themselves from self-imposed tutelage and learning to deal freely with religious and other matters. Religious tutelage is not only the most harmful, but the most degrading of all. As the use of reason gradually spreads, men become more capable of managing their freedom. Indeed, the title of one of Kant's works was Perpetual Peace. If we understood the nature of ourselves and our reasoning ability, we would be able finally to extrapolate how we should live our lives and live our lives properly to produce perpetual peace. So you all have an idea then of what the Enlightenment optimism is all about. Progress, man's perfectibility, the idea of a closed, law-like universe, an antipathy to Christian orthodoxy, the seeking of orderliness everywhere, and a confidence in man's reason to solve all of his problems. But the important thing to note as we come to this juncture in philosophy, even though we're looking at Immanuel Kant as the last great, if you will, thinker of the Enlightenment, the important thing for you to notice, the collapse of confidence that follows the Enlightenment. The collapse of confidence that follows the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment finally brought about a loss of confidence in the rationality of the universe and the rationality of man. We can see various reasons for that. Let's think about scientific advance, especially the application of science to technology. What kind of wonderful world was produced through the advances in science and the Industrial Revolution? Well, basically, we see urban slums. We see people working under miserable conditions in the new factories and so forth. We see a great deal of unpleasantness, if you will, in society and social tension between the economic classes. What about the application of man's reason and the view of man's perfectibility as we see it in the political order? Well, the French Enlightenment led up to the French Revolution, one of the most bloody periods in European history in the name of rationality. The French Revolution, I want you to remember, deified reason. Reason was the goddess of the revolution, explicitly declared the goddess of the revolution. A Frenchman dressed up a woman and carried her, you know, on an elevated platform, and she was to represent reason. I mean, it was a mockery of religious exercise, but nevertheless a declaration that we now follow a new god or goddess. And what did it lead to? The guillotine. So the reign of terror. And then what follows the reign of terror in France? Napoleon. And again, one of the worst despotisms imaginable under a military leader. So when we look at the world around us, scientific advance, we look at the world around us, the political order, man seems far from being a rational, peaceful creature able to control his destiny, regulate his freedom by his own individual reason. In fact, if you take an honest empirical look at society, men seem to be driven not by some kind of self-controlled, rational ability, but by hate and by fear and by selfishness. And that's why when we emerge from the Enlightenment into the 19th century, which is what we'll look at in our next course in this history sequence, man's view of himself is changing greatly. That kind of optimism that was previously put forth in just those schmaltzy ways that I've already quoted for you today, that optimism is gone. It's important for you to realize that the history of philosophy is intelligible only within the broader context of cultural history. Philosophers are not detached minds floating out there just interested in ideas. Philosophers have a milieu. They are concerned with what we might call local problems, not just universal problems. They live their lives not as abstract intellects, but as full-bodied men in a historical setting. Don't ever think that philosophy is immune then from what I call the spirit of the age, the zeitgeist. Philosophy during the Enlightenment was optimistic, confident in reason, confident in the orderliness of nature, confident that God doesn't intervene, that whatever God we have to acknowledge, if any at all, is going to be a domesticated God, one that stays in his place, that is just there to finish our system off if we need to have him. Francis Schaeffer, in your textbook, pursues the collapse of confidence by looking at the cultural milieu of the philosophers. And I do not have time, because it's so short, to go over the textbook, but I'd like to just give you a real brief summary, and then I'll count on you to do your reading. Schaeffer traces the breakdown of humanism in three areas: philosophy, science, and politics. The breakdown in philosophy he discusses on pages 144 to 146 and 151 to 164. You may want to get that map because you're going to write me a paper on that, so I'm kind of giving you what you need to know for organizational purposes. On those pages, the breakdown of philosophy is seen in, first, the discussion of the problem of universals that modern philosophers did not answer. They still did not have an answer for how there can be universals or absolutes in human experience. And this finally leads to a loss of what Schaeffer calls a unified field of knowledge. The loss of a unified field of knowledge. And he shows different dichotomies, Rousseau, Kant, Hegel, etc. Where according to him, you don't have a set of common principles by which you can explain anything in the real world, but rather the world is divided between conflicting principles. Let's just take one example. Nature and freedom. Nature and freedom. On the one hand, nature is controlled by what? It is a mechanistic orderliness, a law-likeness, a predictability. But human dignity is based not on orderliness and law-likeness, but human freedom is based on the idea that we are free, that we use our reason to make decisions for ourselves. And what Schaeffer points out, and that and many other illustrations, is that the Enlightenment ended up with this fact-value, universal, particular, reason, nature, freedom, nature, pardon me, dichotomies that could not account for the world. That reality, this confidence in reason is lost because no longer do we have a unified field of knowledge. Whatever is known has got to be known in one or another ways, and those two cannot be themselves subsumed under a broader order. What I'm getting at is, it's one thing to say you have a realm of nature, the facts, that you can explain in terms of deterministic principles. It's another thing to say that there's a realm of freedom or value, absolutes and universals and so forth, human dignity. The point is, how can you have both unless there is a higher order that unites both ways of thinking? Now, can there be a higher order where facts and values, nature and freedom, are brought together? Well, not according to the Enlightenment, of course, because everything depends upon man's reason. Enlightenment are autonomous. Consequently, autonomous reason always leads to these kind of dichotomies, where reality has to be explained along two different lines, and the two different lines cannot be brought together. We're in a constant state of contradiction then, if I can generalize here. Whereas the Christian doesn't face that problem because there is a higher unity to fact and value, isn't there? Who do we want to go back to and remember in the history of philosophy here? John Calvin. Calvin tells us we cannot understand the world, we cannot understand ourselves without understanding simultaneously, not one before the other, simultaneously understanding God. For Reformation thinkers, God is the source both of the facts, what happens in the natural world by his providence, and also man's freedom and the values by which he lives. And so, though there are different elements of the world to be explained, they are not in constant perpetual conflict for the Christian. They are united in the character and the activity of God. But the Enlightenment comes along and says, we don't want interference from God. We don't want our freedom or the autonomy of our reason to be limited. And so what is left? A divided field of knowledge, the perpetual contradiction. You're talking about nature, you're talking about freedom.
Okay. Now, a lot of secular professors don't seem to feel the problem here. They'll say, well, when it comes to explaining external things, then we have to use scientific principles. We explain the facts in terms of determinism. When it comes to internal things, man's personality, then we have values and freedom. What you want to say is, well, but man lives in this external world. How can man have such freedom if he lives in the world that's controlled, you know, deterministically? How can man have these values if there's nothing but disjointed facts out there? On the other hand, if you begin with man, you say, well, man does have freedom. There is value in this world. Well, then how can you have a scientific approach to the world and an orderliness to the facts? Okay, this is humanism's breakdown in philosophy, according to Schaeffer. Secondly, he says, we see the breakdown of humanism in the realm of science, pages 146 to 151, and then 164 to 166. Essentially, the Enlightenment is a promotes a materialistic view of the world. Granted, many Enlightenment thinkers were deists, but the God that they were interested in was only a convenience for their system. They had to have a beginning and they had to have some guarantee of justice at the end. For the most part, though, Hobbes is the Enlightenment example, and then those who follow in his train of a materialistic view. Well, materialism leads to what? A deterministic view of man. And in a deterministic view, we expect an evolutionary explanation of man's origin. Materialism, determinism, evolution. Well, a few moments ago when I was summarizing the Enlightenment, what was man? Man was great, right? Man had reason. Man had dignity. Man had perfectibility. Well, I mean, for a while in this transition period, you might try to hold together a materialistic, deterministic view of man and his perfectibility and so forth. When you stop and think about that, if man is nothing more but evolutionary slime, if he's nothing more but an advanced animal, then what you get as one expression of this conviction is the Nazi movement in Germany. Now, I realize we've jumped ahead, but what we're doing is we're looking at this seed that was planted and now considering its fruit. And the fruit of the materialistic, deterministic, evolutionary view of man, Schaeffer says, it's the Nazis. Now how much dignity and perfectibility do we see in man? Dignity? Man is slime. He's just nothing more but another animal. Perfectibility? How about the Nazis? And so man loses his dignity and is dehumanized by the Enlightenment, Schaeffer points out, and this in his discussion of science. Then thirdly, Schaeffer considers humanism's breakdown in the realm of politics, and we've already made reference to this, just a reminder. You'll find this on pages 120 to 128 in your textbook. Schaeffer looks at two revolutions, the French Revolution, 1789, and following, and then the Russian Revolution of 1917. What do you want to say about the perfectibility of man, confidence in his reason now? The French Revolution leads to the Reign of Terror to a period of despotism. The Russian Revolution was a little bit better. There was a short period of bloodshed, but for the most part, it just went directly into despotism. The Bolshevik Revolution, imposes, the oversight of the state, and those who were arguing against the Tsar and then against the short period of liberalism in Russia become worse than the Tsar himself in terms of trying to control every facet of Russian life. So there you have it. The Enlightenment with its optimism about the rationality of the universe in man, leading finally to the collapse of confidence because of unpleasant and surprising consequences and the breakdown of humanism in philosophy, science, and politics. So let me step back and try to give you a recapitulation and synopsis of the period we've been studying. I'll go back to last term's course on ancient and medieval to begin, though. I just want you to see the general sequence. Ancient philosophy had an emphasis upon independence, autonomy, and self-realization. Independence, autonomy, self-realization. Medieval philosophy tried to, in some way, synthesize that ancient autonomy with an emphasis on God as the creator who's infinitely good and before whom man must deal with his own sin. When we get to the Renaissance, remember, we have seeds of Renaissance that grow up. We don't wake up one day and say, oh, we'll start the Renaissance today. But as the Renaissance comes, man is reborn. Of course, as Schaeffer says, it's not really man that is reborn. It's a concept of man that is reborn. And what concept of man is reborn? The ancient Greek concept. Man's independence, self-realization, and autonomy. In the Renaissance, we see the autonomous man considering questions of political sovereignty, concerned with this world in which he lives, the natural environment, and understanding it, and gaining values by which to live in terms of it. The discovery of nature, the development of the scientific method. But as I pointed out, what we end up in the Renaissance with is another dichotomy between values on the one hand and facts on the other. We have free men who pursue values, but then the Renaissance also said we live in a neutral world of mechanical facts. And so the Renaissance creates this dilemma. The world of facts seems indifferent to man and his affairs. So how, in a neutral, predictable, deterministic world of facts, can man find a place for his capacity to freely choose things, to choose a good, and develop his own perfectibility? There's the dilemma. Scientifically, you have the facts. They're neutral. There's no value. But man who is free is choosing values. How can the free man find values in a world of neutral mechanistic facts? Let's go through our various philosophers very quickly. I'll utilize what I think is a nice summary of this period by W.T. Jones. He says, Hobbes, the first of these thinkers, wholeheartedly adopted what seemed to him the new scientific worldview. Only matter in motion exists. Men's thoughts and desires are but the byproducts of motions occurring in their cortexes and caused by events in the physical environment. It follows that there are no metaphysically based standards by which to determine the objective truth of thoughts or the true value of desires. Accordingly, Hobbes concluded that men need a sovereign who by arbitrary decree establishes and by overwhelming force maintains what is true and what is good. That seemed to be a radical position. Most philosophers didn't want to accept it. Descartes replaced the materialistic monism of Hobbes with a metaphysical dualism. According to him, there are two kinds of substance. Let me see if I can trace this real quickly on the board as we go along. First, we have materialism in Hobbes, and then we have dualism with Descartes. There are two kinds of substance. Material substance, for which the laws discovered by the scientific revolution hold true. And there's mental substance, man's spirit or self, for which the old insights about man as a teleological being with an immortal soul can still be applied. With this Cartesian compromise, broke down on the mind-body problem. Man, it would appear, is a material substance, for the movements of his body are a part of the physical universe and as such are completely predictable. But he's also a spiritual substance and can freely choose to follow God's commands or refuse to follow them. How can two such radically different substances interact as they seem to do whenever a man wills to move his arm or his leg? This leads us to Spinoza. He retained the Cartesian concept of substance and sought to reconcile physics with theology by denying interaction and downgrading sense perception, which is nothing more than confused thought. Okay, so Spinoza comes up with a spiritual monism. It's not a spiritual monism. It's a material monism. No, it's not a material monism. Well, then what is it? It's pantheism. That's right. So now we have a pantheistic view that says that these two substances are not substances, they're just attributes of the one substance. The totality of all things can be talked about mentally or spiritually. Leibniz doesn't like that. He doesn't like that monism. So Leibniz gives us a spiritual atomism. Reality is made up of a bunch of bits, if you will, of energy, consciousness. But what Leibniz and Spinoza have in common is they hold to the concept of substance, they deny interaction, and they downgrade sense perception. You want to get those three things in your notes. They hold on to Descartes' concept of substance, they now deny interaction, and they downgrade perception. These are the continental rationalists. You should emphasize the use of reason. Locke adopted a very different strategy for dealing with the problems with which these philosophers were wrestling. Instead of dismissing perception as unreliable and holding that pure reason can work out a correct metaphysical solution, Locke held that the concepts of reason must now meet the test of the historical plane method. That is, now your concepts must be verified in sense experience. Where Descartes, and then especially Spinoza and Leibniz, derogated sense perception, Locke said, no, sense perception is the most important thing. Now let's put up on the board here, sense perception test, then. Locke maintained a fairly traditional view, mind and body substances. Berkeley took the sense perception test and knocked matter out of the universe. Berkeley said, there's nothing in experience named by this term matter. All we encounter are qualities. Solidity, fluidity, heaviness, lightness, whatever it may be. And so now, half of the dualism of Descartes, which comes back in Locke's sense perception test, is knocked out. So, matter. In Hume's hands, the empirical criterion of meaning, the plain historical method of Locke, becomes an even more vicious weapon. Judged by the empirical approach of Locke, it's not just matter that needs to be dismissed, it's external objects, causation, and even the self as the center of experience of the world is gone. And of course, God is out of the question for Hume. We have no, you know, empirical basis for God. So matter is dismissed by Berkeley, and all the other important metaphysical concepts, including God, self, external objects, and causation, are dismissed by Hume. And so by the time we get to Hume, I want you to understand how important this man is. By the time we get to Hume, all of the basic concepts by which Western philosophers had thought they could organize and interpret reality are gone. Hey, so much for confidence in man's reason, right? And so there is, if you will, an intellectual pessimism by the time we get to Hume and his revolutionary conclusions, an intellectual pessimism about being able to interpret reality and human experience. Prior to Hume, we have a succession of metaphysical options given to us. Obviously, I don't believe all of them are true, but I do want you to see this in general, that ancient philosophy led to, if you will, the grand metaphysical views of Plato on the one hand, Aristotle on the other. Medieval philosophy leads to the grand metaphysical synthesis of St. Thomas Aquinas. Both the ancient world and the medieval world felt that you could come to a metaphysical scheme that provides unity to man's life, understanding and reality, cohesion to culture. But as the Renaissance grows up into the Enlightenment, what we are left with is not metaphysical schemes that bring cohesion. We have simply a bunch of questions that nobody can answer. Again, I don't necessarily agree with the previous answers that were offered, obviously, by Plato or Aristotle or Aquinas. But the point is, during all of those hundreds of years, men felt they could come to answers. By the time we get to Hume, guess what? All you got is questions left now. So let me give you a synopsis of what we have studied. And I'm going to ask that you write this down word for word, because I'm going to want you to explain it to me later. A synopsis of what we have seen. Modern philosophy hinges on epistemology. Modern philosophy hinges on epistemology. Period. Autonomous or humanistic philosophy says that the justification of beliefs might be by means of a priori rationalist methods or a posteriori empiricist methods. I'm going to say it again. Don't despair. I've done this many times. I am a trained professional. Trust me. Don't do this at home. It could be dangerous. Modern philosophy hinges on epistemology. Autonomous or humanistic philosophy says the justification of beliefs might be by means of a priori, that is, rationalist methods, or a posteriori, that is, empiricist methods. Everybody with me? I'm going to continue. Rationalism appears to be arbitrary, and few people are confident of its metaphysical inferences. Rationalism appears to be arbitrary, and few people are confident of its metaphysical inferences. Whether monistic, dualistic, or atomistic. Whether monistic, dualistic, or atomistic. Next sentence. By rejecting any innate ideas, empiricism appears to result in skepticism, or a lack of certainty about any metaphysics. By rejecting any innate ideas, empiricism appears to result in skepticism, or a lack of certainty about any metaphysics. And so at the end of the Enlightenment, we can say, we thus need a worldview which can save certainty. We thus need a worldview which can save certainty and which provides the preconditions for rational and empirical methods. One more time. We thus need a worldview which saves certainty and provides the preconditions for rational and empirical methods. Let me take a time out here and just play the part of coach and not just instructor. I want you to feel good about yourselves. If I had come in here 2 weeks ago and on the first day of the course given you this sentence, you all would have been blown away. You would have said, what on earth is he talking about? And although you may want to do some brush up and look up some words, the fact is today I can read this to you and you can make some sense out of it. And you understand not only some sense here in all of this philosophical vocabulary, but you've come to understand a very important period of history, and you now understand it apologetically. As Christians, you see the superiority of your Calvinistic theology, because Calvinism provides a worldview that does what? It saves certainty. You can know things for sure, and it provides the preconditions for rational as well as empirical methods of learning or knowing. We escape the arbitrariness of the rationalist, and we disagree with the rejection of innate ideas on the part of the empiricist. What we're really doing here, to put it simply, is you're getting now to the very center of the steak. This is the nicest part of the meal, what I've just given you. Let me read it to you again. Modern philosophy hinges on epistemology, the theory of knowledge. Autonomous philosophy, which refuses to submit to God, tries to be independent and so forth, autonomous philosophy says that the justification of beliefs might be by means of a priori rationalistic methods or a posteriori empiricist methods. But rationalism appears to be arbitrary. Very few people are confident of its metaphysical inferences. And just look at the conflicts between Descartes the dualist, Spinoza the monist, and Leibniz the atomist. So you go the other way and say, okay, don't count on a priori methods, try a posteriori methods. So the empiricists reject any innate ideas. But the empiricists have their own problems. Berkeley gets rid of material substance. Hume gets rid of immaterial substance, causation, external objects. And so empiricism results in skepticism, a lack of certainty about any metaphysics. It's not just that you have disagreements as the rationalist, now you have no metaphysical answers whatsoever. And what we need, therefore, is a worldview that can save certainty and provide the preconditions for rational and empirical methods. And it's my belief that Christianity, or if you will, the outlook of John Calvin, summarized as the Reformation outlook, provides just that worldview that the history of philosophy needs. All right, D in your outline. What we see then is that the Enlightenment has taken us from confidence in the rationality of the universe and man to despair. Despair doesn't mean people are walking around with long faces and just going, oh, gloom. But we have lost the confidence. We certainly lost, if you will, the large-scale projects of previous ages of philosophy. No metaphysical syntheses are being proposed. No unified worldviews. We have a divided field of knowledge. We have all these other problems. The optimism of the 1700s, where nature seemed to be beneficent, people seemed to be rational, where progress seemed to be inevitable, that optimism suffered heavy blows. The Industrial Revolution, the French Revolution, and then above all, Hume's skepticism. There is a loss of any confidence in objectivity, rationality, or values. And as I've tried to make very clear, I think the greatest part of this shift from confidence to despair is due to Hume's advocating the idea that there are no necessary connections among matters of fact. You have perception, no connection between the perceptions. Hume, you see, has destroyed the Enlightenment confidence in reason. He's destroyed the Enlightenment confidence in the orderliness of nature. Reason can tell us nothing about the real world outside. Moreover, there is no rationale in nature by which man's rational mind is to conform. And so, if you will, Hume is driving a wedge between nature and reason. Nature and reason. And if you've been following the dichotomies on the board that we've been looking at, maybe you can see how revolutionary, how devastating this is. Because previously, we had nature and reason together in one category over against faith and value, didn't we? I mean, that's a bad enough dichotomy, grant you. It's one that we as Christians are not going to accept. But I just want you to see how bad things are going for the other team, if you will. Here we have theology at the end of the Middle Ages separated from philosophy. Okay? That is to say, we have faith separated from reason. Now later, we get the realm of value separated from the realm of fact, which is the realm of the natural world, the realm where man's reason operates. Okay, so just look at the board here. The first set of divisions has theology and faith over against philosophy and reason. And as we work forward, what we have is a division between value and freedom in one area of our thinking, and then fact, nature, and reason in the other. But, and here's the kicker, when you get to Hume, now you've got to separate reason and nature. That's how skeptical his conclusions are. Man's reason is a matter of what? Imagination, filling in the gaps between loose and separate perceptions. And the natural world cannot be understood by reason. The natural world has no rationale, no causality, no enduring objects. And so confidence in reason, get this in your notes, confidence in reason, Renaissance and Enlightenment approaches, confidence in reason ends up with a question about the uselessness of reason. That is, Hume's skepticism makes the usefulness of reason and understanding nature now questionable. And of the contemporaries of Hume, perhaps the one philosopher who more than any other saw better than those of his day the destructive force of Hume's philosophy is Immanuel Kant. Kant, as you know, was personally committed to the Enlightenment outlook. And so he was deeply disturbed by what Hume had argued. Kant realized that we need a new approach, a new scheme, if metaphysics is going to be saved. And yet, when we get done with our lecture on Kant, I hope I will have showed you that Kant himself made many more concessions to an anti-rationalist approach to philosophy than he himself realized. Kant's philosophy is nothing less than the major turning point in Western thought. That doesn't mean I like his philosophy. It doesn't mean that I'm going to agree with the way he approaches things. But I want you to know that there's hardly a more revolutionary philosopher in the history of thought than Immanuel Kant. And why? Because Kant was jolted by Hume's skepticism. Let's ask ourselves, how can people respond to Hume? There's really only three ways. You can respond to Hume by trying to work out a rational philosophy on a completely different basis. I mean, Hume had taken the Renaissance and Enlightenment approach, and if you stay with its premises, he drove it right into the ground. So if you're going to answer Hume, you're going to have to start and do philosophy a different way. Now, this is what Kant did, and we're going to come to that in a minute. Secondly, you can take refuge in an authority that's beyond man's autonomous reason. Take refuge in an authority that is beyond man's autonomous reason. Now, there are different forms of rejecting man's autonomous reason. One is political totalitarianism. Okay, you can just have the state impose answers on you, as in the former USSR. Or you can appeal to the authority of the institutional church. Roman Catholics are not as, if you will, shattered by Hume because they can always make reference to the authority of the church or the priest speaking for God. You can make reference to something that is outside of man's rational autonomy because you look to man's autonomy in sentiment, romanticism. Or there's a third way you can deal with Hume's skepticism. You can simply boldly face life in this unknown world and reject the ideal of certainty and just try to make the best of it. Mitigated skepticism says, hey, you can't know anything for sure, but that's okay, we're getting by just fine. Life in this world doesn't require certainty. We can be successful without it. We're willing to take provisional solutions as long as they work in solving our problems, and that'll be the answer of pragmatism. So I've given you kind of an overview now of what's going to happen after Hume. We're going to look for a new way to do philosophy. That's Kant. Or we're going to go to some kind of authority outside.